If you spend much time online, on a computer or a cell phone, then you probably know what it's like to feel distracted and unfocused. You're trying to get some work done, but email and Facebook, texts and tweets keep popping up. Maybe you're feeling anxious, stressed out about work or family. I'm Anne Strange-Hampson, and psychologist and science writer Daniel Goleman is here with us this hour to talk about the new science of attention. And to make the case that how we pay attention, how we focus our minds, is the secret ingredient that drives high performance and life satisfaction. Dan Goleman is a familiar voice on public radio. He's the author of 10 books, including the landmark Emotional Intelligence. And he's just written a new book called Focus. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Anne. I'm happy to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So you call focus the hidden driver of excellence. Why hidden?
Hidden because it's so elusive. It's so subtle. We don't notice our attention because we have to use our attention to notice it in the first place. And our attention is usually focused on what we're doing, what we're listening. As you say, the tweets and all of that, All the distractions of life or the things that we choose to focus on. Very rarely do we stop to notice noticing itself.
and a nice paradox. So you wrote the book partly in order to dig into some new science of attention. Is this a new field?
Well, the field of attention has been around pretty much since World War II. It started when they wanted to figure out who would be the best radar operator, who could sustain what we call vigilance, a mode of attention where you're ready to watch, you're ready to notice, but nothing much is happening. It takes a lot of patience. Since then, the field has gone through stops and starts. But in the last two or three years, there's been an upsurge in neuroscientific looks at the attention circuitry in the brain, which has opened up a vast new understanding. That was why I decided to write the book.
Well, we should sort of try to clarify what you mean by attention, what we're talking about. Because, for instance, I think we tend to think of focus or attention as a kind of on-off switch. You're either paying attention or you're not. You're either doing your work or daydreaming. But attention turns out to be kind of more complicated than that, right?
Well, yes, there are many varieties of attention, and each one has its function and its place. As you pointed out in your intro, many of them are out of place and are getting in the way of our having control over our own attention. It's harder and harder these days to keep your focus where you want it to be. As you know, I've got a pop-up on my computer that says there's an email and there's the phone and there's tweets and, you know, all of the digital interruptions, which I think are eroding our ability to pay attention. And then there's relationships. I mean, paying attention to the other person, empathy, is what makes us connect, what helps us have fruitful relationships. You go to a restaurant these days and you'll see a couple out for a romantic dinner. They're both looking at their phones. They're not looking in each other's eyes.
Right.
But what I really worry about, Anne, is kids. Because I think today's children are growing up in an environment, an attentional surround, which is more distracting than ever. And the attention circuitry of the brain continues to develop from birth into the 20s. And because of what we call neuroplasticity in neuroscience, which means the brain is shaped by repeated experiences, children need the ability, need the room, need the space, need the time to pay sustained attention. Instead of having their attention driven by a video game or by tweets or by, you know, their texts from their best friend or whatever it is.
Yeah, and the thing
and,
that's...
And that's changed.
And the thing that's difficult about all of this, I think, is I think we all, whether we're parents or simply people who work online or own cell phones, I think we're all aware that a kind of attention that we used to have and a kind of ability to focus our attention is under threat. But it's so hard to turn that stuff off. I mean, it's sort of addictive.
Yeah, it's so seductive, isn't it? And it's seductive because the people who design those systems are very clever at using the weak spots in the what we call the bottom-up brain. The bottom-up brain is totally automatic. It operates out of our awareness. What we think of as our attention, our ability to concentrate, say, is a narrow part of the mind, but it It's the one part that we have control over. We can decide where we're going to put our attention. The bottom-up brain, though, is where, for example, emotional distractions come from. Those are the most powerful kind. You know, the things that are upsetting us, what's not working in that relationship that's so important. That's where our mind drifts to. And, you know, our mind wanders about 50% of the time on average. So the emotional distractors, those are natural. You know, evolution put them right there in the brain. But now people who are designing apps and so on are very good at finding ways to seduce us to what they want us to pay attention to without our noticing until we're locked in. And, you know, after a while you realize, oh, my gosh, I'm not doing that work anymore.
Well, and then it's kind of a perpetual cycle, right, because you have trouble focusing. You know, let's say you've got a paper to write or something important to do and your mind keeps wandering, then you get anxious, right? So then once you start getting anxious and worried, then you think, oh, I'm so bad at this. I'm not going to be any good. Oh, I'm messing up again.
Which, of course, is making it worse and worse and worse.
Right. Yeah.
However, I think the good news is that we can take back control. For one thing, there are simple ways to strengthen our attention. It's a mental muscle. And just as you go to the gym, you know, every time you lift a weight, every rep strengthens that muscle. There are exercises now that we can do that will strengthen the connectivity in the neural circuitry for attention. In other words, help us make our attention stronger, and so we can resist those temptations to wander, or when we can notice when our mind is distracted and bring it back.
Well, I had no idea until I read your book how many kinds of simple exercises and therapies scientists have been coming up with lately to deal with attention issues. I mean, really a wide range of them, from, say, anxiety issues to what we're talking about, more kind of selective focus issues. So let's talk about some of them. I mean, you know, what's an example of a way you can strengthen your attention muscle?
One of the most inspiring things I saw, I describe it in the book Focus, is I went to a second grade classroom in Spanish Harlem, in a public school. Spanish Harlem is a very impoverished part of New York, and the kids in the school live largely in the housing projects next door. They have very tough lives. And every day, these seven-year-olds go to their cubby and get a favorite little stuffed animal, find a spot on the floor to lie down, put that animal on their tummy, and they watch it rise when they breathe in and fall when they breathe out. They count 1, 2, 3 on the in-breath, 1, 2, 3 on the out-breath. And what they're doing is strengthening the circuitry for attention, which is critical for kids because the ability to learn depends on your ability to pay attention to what the teacher is saying, to the textbook. Your ability, it turns out, to manage disturbing, distressing emotions, the anxieties you're talking about, turns out to use the same circuitry that you're strengthening by that simple exercise. The brain economizes on neural circuitry. So the more focused you become, the more concentrated you become, the better you become at managing emotional distractions. Technically, it's called cognitive control. And cognitive control, the ability to keep your mind on one thing and ignore the temptation to let it wander off to something else, turns out to predict someone's financial success and their health as adults. This is when measured in childhood.
Now, remember the famous marshmallow study, the one where they said
Marshmallow test is a measure of cognitive control, exactly what I'm talking about. Because in the marshmallow test, for those who aren't familiar with it, four-year-olds at Stanford University preschool are brought into a room one by one, sit down at a small table, big juicy marshmallows there. The experimenter says, you can have this marshmallow now if you want, but if you'll wait till I run an errand and you don't eat it till I get back, you can have two then. Then she disappears. You know, this is a predicament that tries the soul of any four-year-old. I've seen videos. It's very cute. Some of them will sniff it and then jump back like it was dangerous, or others will, you know, wander off and sing to themselves to distract themselves. About a third of the kids grab it on the spot. Another third wait out the endless 10 minutes or whatever, and they get the two. But the payoff, actually, from the study came 14 years later when the kids are about to graduate from high school. They're tracked down again. And it turns out those who waited compared to the ones who grabbed still can delay gratification in pursuit of their goals. That's exactly what that tests. But they also had a 210-point advantage on the SAT. That's out of 1,600.
Wow.
That's an immense difference. And remember, these are all kids from Stanford University families.
So I think of that as a test of willpower. What do you mean when you say it's a test of a kind of attention also?
Willpower is a way of talking about the very same mental faculty. Willpower means I'm going to keep doing this and not do that. The essence of that, the foundation of that ability, is I'm going to keep my attention here and not have it go there. Or when it does go there, I'm going to bring it back every time. And it, by the way, it's the bringing back that strengthens the neural circuitry.
So you're talking about taking control of your mind, not just letting your control, mind do whatever it wants.
And as Yoda said, your focus is your reality. It's taking control of your life.
Right. What's interesting is that, of course, we have by now a growing body of science on how to take control of your mind. That's mindfulness, right? That's mindfulness meditation, which we've been studying for, I don't know, 20 years or something. But we don't tend to think of mindfulness in terms of focus, right? It seems softer.
Every kind of meditation, and mindfulness is a meditation, is a training exercise in attention. If you strip away the belief system, and by the way, there are meditations within every major world religion, take away the belief system and look at it just from a cognitive science point of view, what you're doing is holding a single attentional stance. And when your mind wanders off to something else, you bring it back to that stance. Mindfulness actually refers to the ability to notice where your mind is and when it's wandered to bring it back to your point of focus. So those kids, you could say, who are with the little belly buddies, we're doing mindfulness. And it's interesting that a lot of businesses now, starting with Google most famously, have been introducing mindfulness for employees because it's not just kids who are suffering from distractedness. Everybody has the same problem.
Right. Now, we're talking about the ability to focus. And earlier we were talking about the different kinds of attention. There's also a kind of attention you write about called open awareness, right? Can you explain what that is?
Well, yes, and here I really need to give credit to someone from Wisconsin. That is Richard Davidson at Madison University of Wisconsin.
We know him well.
His research, I've known Richie, as we call him, for a long time, but I've drawn in this book on a lot of his work, particularly in his excellent book, The Emotional Life of the Brain, where he summarizes six brain styles, as he calls them, that differentiate people and are very revealing. And one of them is this ability to sustain what he calls an open awareness. It's really full sensory openness, being tuned into the moment. This is what you want to have, you know, on that summer day at the lake. This is what you want to have when you're with your lover. This is, or the people you love. It's being fully in the moment and just taking it in, not thinking about work, not thinking about anything else. Just being present to where you are.
And is that also a kind of focus, would you say?
It's a different kind of attention. It's a different way to deploy attention. And that's the beautiful thing, I think, about attention, is that we can use it in many ways for many different purposes. So we often talk about focus as though it were only concentration, but actually it's a wide variety of things, including open awareness, even mind wandering. Which in some ways is the direct enemy of focus, has its pleasures and its place. If you want to be creative, if you want to come up with that new way of putting disparate elements together that's novel, never been done before, but has a real use, in other words, a real innovation, you've got to let your mind wander. It won't happen while you're too concentrated.
That reminds me of something else you write about, attention restoration theory. Let's start there. When we come back, we're going to take a quick break. I'm talking with science writer Daniel Goleman about his new book, Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. Daniel's written 10 books, including the groundbreaking Emotional Intelligence. We'd love to hear from you in this hour. Do you have questions about how to improve your ability to focus or pay attention? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can email us. The address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Anne Strain-Champs, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 4 on Central Time, Veronica Rickard and Rob Ferret explore the day's top stories. They'll hear some new songs and review the week's headlines. Right now we're talking with psychologist and science writer Daniel Goleman about his new book, Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. And Dan, before the break, I was mentioning something I found really interesting in your book. You mentioned something called attention restoration theory. What is that?
Attention restoration theory deals with the fact that concentration or effortful sustaining of attention burns up the brain's energy supply, which is basically glucose, and we become depleted. And the signs of getting depleted are, you know, you're distractible, maybe you're a little irritable, your mind's wandering when you really don't want it to. And there's a group at Michigan who have come up with a theory that what we should do at times like that is just take a break. But it's an interesting kind of break. It's a break for attention. And that means just going outside, for example, going in nature. They highly recommend if there's a park nearby or you can go for a walk, where you just let your mind roam and rest. You know, maybe you get into that full sensory awareness, being in the moment, or just let it go. And according to this theory, that kind of revives us. There's a complementary theory that's going around these days, particularly in work circles, and that is the idea of taking naps. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of cultures. I was just in Barcelona and try to go to a store there after lunch. Right. Forget it. Everyone's home having a siesta. And there's some good science now that says, you know, even a short nap reboots the brain. It brings you back to that level of high energy, high mental energy.
You know, whereas so, what most of us often do, right, is you start to have that feeling that you're a little burned out, so we surf the web, which seems like exactly the opposite of what you're talking about.
Well, surfing the web isn't actually one of the recommended ways to do it. If it works to you, for you, more power to you, but I think going for a walk might be better.
Yeah. We've got some listeners who have called and with questions. Let's hear from Jeff.
Sure.
In Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, good morning. I'm chuckling a little bit. I'm supposed to be here at home focusing on design of a workshop dealing with issues of emotional intelligence and leadership styles, which I'm giving next week. And I have been distracted by this great show, which is focusing on Daniel Goleman's views on focus. Now, how is that for irony? I do have a question. My question is this. My mother-in-law, unfortunately, has recently been checked into an Alzheimer's wing, and I'm wondering, is there any new science, any new findings neurologically, whatever, with regard to improving capacity to focus for seniors with severe dementia, number one, and number two, I guess, actually, with Alzheimer's? Mm. I'll listen off the air.
Okay. Thanks, Jeff.
Jeff, I'm sorry to hear about your mother. There is some interesting new understanding of how to relate to people with Alzheimer's. And unfortunately, it's not about rebuilding attention. I don't think we're there yet. But it's about connecting with a part of the person which is still intact. Often it's a nonverbal part, you know, and it's not about what just happened. It's about something that is really deeply ingrained in that person's repertoire. For example, songs that person likes, or some activity that was always a favorite. That what they're saying is to try to bring the person out more or engage the person in that domain. So that's my one thought. And also, by the way, just so that this isn't a complete waste of time for you on your assignment on emotional intelligence, next week the Harvard Business Review has an article that I've written integrating focus with leadership and emotional intelligence. Basically, what I say is that there are three kinds of focus every leader needs. There's an inner focus, which is the self-awareness and self-management domains in the emotional intelligence model. There's focus on other people, which is the empathy and relationship domains of competency. And then I added one, which is the outer focus, a systems focus. Being able to understand the forces impinging on an organization, for instance, so you can come up with strategy. Jeff, I'm just telling you that so that you won't feel that you were totally distracted and what a waste.
But wait, because that's also one of the really interesting sections in the book is these three different kinds of focus that people in leadership or I think any kind of workplace need. So let's take them apart a little bit. Inner focus, other focus, outer focus.
Sure.
Let's start with inner.
Well, inner focus is the ability to tune into the subtle signals, often just a felt sense, that are the way your brain tells you what your life wisdom on the moment's decision is. Feels right, doesn't feel right. That is not silly information. That's real information. That's the summation of your life experience on the decision at the moment. The brain can't tell you that in words because the part of the brain that knows this doesn't have a direct connection to the part of the brain that thinks in words. So it does take an act of self-awareness. This is, by the way, an ethical rudder that feels right, doesn't feel right.
Know yourself. This is what Marcus Aurelius said.
Exactly. And from this inner awareness also comes the ability to manage yourself emotionally. In other words, notice when you're starting to get frustrated with someone or starting to get anxious. If you don't notice it, you're going to have an emotional hijack and maybe do something or say something you regret later. But if you can see it coming, you have time, you have room to do something about it before it gets out of control.
This is what I often think of as being a grown-up, actually, or especially being a grown-up. Well, being a grown-up in the workplace means not just unleashing your emotions on everyone else.
Totally. I've heard maturity defined as increasing the gap between impulse and action. And it's only that inner awareness that's going to help you increase the gap.
Okay, so that's...
You're 100% right.
So that's inner focus. Now, how about other focus, the next one we need to be successful?
Other focus has to do with empathy. And there are three kinds of empathy, researchers are telling us. One is what they call cognitive empathy, which means you understand how the other person thinks about things, how they see the world, what their mental models are. And this allows you to communicate very effectively because you know how to put things in a way that will resonate with them. The second kind is emotional empathy. And this has to do with very quick, unconscious brain systems that link brain to brain whenever we interact with someone. And they create actually in our brain and body the feelings the other person is having. And some people are better at emotional empathy than others. But this is what allows you really to feel rapport with someone else, to feel really close and connected. Then there's a third kind, which is called empathic concern, which is not just that you get how the person sees the world or is feeling now, but also what they need, if they are in need, and what you could do to help, and being predisposed actually to go ahead and help. And this is very important, and of course, in a parent or a friend. It's a very important leader, too.
Sure, you're describing the boss everybody wishes they had, right?
Exactly. Instead of that other boss that we all wish we didn't have. These are the dimensions that differentiate between the good boss and the bad boss.
Okay, and then outer focus.
The outer focus is that systems awareness I was alluding to, where you can read the technological changes that are coming or the economic forces at work. Or the environmental forces that we all need to pay attention to. And you can come up with a way of acting into the future, sometimes called strategy, which really rides the waves the best.
Mm. So this is about being able to have not just a very selective focus on your particular work problem, but being able to also cultivate an ability to focus on the big picture.
Precisely. As I said, there are many varieties of attention, and these are the three that I feel every leader in particular needs to have working. If you don't have one of those going, you're operating on two cylinders, not three.
Okay. Well, let's hear from some other listeners. We've got Jeff on the line from La Crosse. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. I'm someone who was diagnosed later on in life with attention deficit hyperactive disorder. Mm-hmm. And in the choices that I made and the things that I did as I was growing up, I was kept in a very close and cloistered environment, fear of God and the belt, those kinds of things. And over time, it developed into the type of career paths and choices that I made. And from that, now I'm helping kids that have been diagnosed in that same vein. And I see a definite pattern in the fact that someone who cannot maybe focus on what is specifically given to them, but can generally look at a big picture and react instantly to things, have you looked at that in a lot of detail as far as how much that affects kids that have ADHD in the mm-hmm. beginning, whether it's treated or moderately treated, and then up into adulthood.
Okay.
Yeah, Jeff, that's a great question. And it's all about attention. You know, during the school years in particular, we put so much emphasis on the ability to concentrate, as I've been talking about, learning readiness and so on. And that's where the diagnosis typically comes up during childhood. But really what's going on is that there's some brains that seem to be wired to wander more and to concentrate less. And those are the people who end up in this category. Later in life, it's interesting. If you look at very successful entrepreneurs like Richard Branson, who started Virgin Airlines, Virgin Records, and so on, they very often, disproportionately, have this kind of diagnosis in childhood and had a very rough time in school. But it's because they can, as you said, see the big picture, react instantly to what's coming and so on. They come up with great innovations often.
Hmm. Are you saying they're hidden gifts to attention deficit disorder?
So exactly. There's a lot of literature now that shows that people with ADHD in childhood turn out to be more creative as adults. And if you can find your way to a calling or a job situation where that's a strength, you can do very well. On the other hand, I also feel, and I'm sure, Jeff, you might agree, that we all should have the ability to focus when we want to and where we want to for good reason. And there are some new methods coming along that are being studied that aren't, the Ritalin, give the kid the pill or the three mm-hmm. pills or whatever, but actually use the ability of the brain to strengthen its connectivity, the circuitry for paying attention when you want to.
So, for
and
example,
helping kids strengthen it.
For example, what might help a kid who's been diagnosed with ADHD other than Ritalin?
Well, a lot of researchers are betting on mindfulness, actually. Huh. On the kind of exercise where you keep bringing your mind back. There's a new game. Actually, Richard Davidson, again, at Wisconsin, was one of the co-developers with a team of video game designers at University of Wisconsin.
Right.
Who designed a game called Tenacity, where you focus on your breath. You play it with an iPad. You tap the screen of the iPad every time you breathe out. On the fifth breath, you tap it twice. This gets more difficult as you get good at it. Every time you do it well, you get a visual reward. And what this is doing is creating a game around paying attention. But it's exactly the same thing, kind of training, that they're doing, that public school in Spanish Harlem. It's bringing the mind back whenever it wanders. And as I said, every time you do that, it strengthens the connectivity. So there are several universities where there are studies going on now with interventions like this for kids with ADHD. Mm. And I think in the next couple of years, we'll hear more about it.
I just saw that game demonstrated at a breakfast for adults.
Really?
The adults could not keep their hands off that game.
it's pretty fun, actually.
Something to look for. Let's also hear from Kay in Madison. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I also have ADHD and was mm-hmm. diagnosed when I was older. But the best way I can describe Ritalin use for me is it's like putting on my glasses in the morning.
Right, sure.
I can see better. The things come into focus.
Right.
And the other thing that's been most helpful to me is, not only meditation, but prayer. And I went on a weekend retreat where I could just kind of get away from all the external stimulation. And that was very helpful. And then I have a coach that I work with who, when I get off the track, can remind me of what I said my priorities were. And do I still want to do what I had planned, or am I off in a different direction and that's okay to do that? At least it's a more conscious way for me to look at my path, and if I'm off the track, decide what to do next.
Okay, that's so interesting. It sounds like you found your way to exactly what, Daniel, you've been talking about.
Well, I think, Kay, you're doing all the right things. It sounds like it is working for you, and I commend you for that. Also, I'd like to spotlight one thing you said, which is looking at your priorities with a coach and reminding yourself. This is what's called a workaround. No matter what the pattern is in the brain, and we call it ADHD, you have certain strengths and certain limitations. The question is, can you draw on your strengths and work around your limitations? And I think a lot of the coaching for adults with ADHD draws on that strategy, and sounds like you're spot on.
Daniel, would you say that we're the kind of culture we're in today? We talked about this digitally distracted age we're in earlier in the hour. Would you say that in some ways we're developing a culture that encourages or actually kind of fosters attention deficits?
Well, I would say that we're in a culture that takes advantage for marketing purposes of the fact that our mind so easily wanders off and we're so easily tempted. Think about fashion, or think about cars. Every year, there's a new design on a car. Basically, it's the same vehicle with a few tweaks, but it looks different enough that it activates another attentional system, which is called the orienting response. By the way, the same is true in fall, spring fashion changes. What's happening is that people are selling us the same old thing, but wrapped up in a way which excites the brain. The orienting response occurs whenever we see something new, novel, or surprising. And what marketers want to do is continually come up with something that's new, novel, and surprising. You know, what's the real difference between last season's phone and this season's phone? Maybe one thing. Well, why don't you just get it as an app? It's because they want us to buy the new phone. So I'd say that our economy is based on certain attentional tricks.
And so the orienting response you're talking about, that's what we have evolved over centuries to, you know, deal with new threats or get used to changes in the environment. And so when something new comes along, the new phone, the new car, our brain is almost hardwired to want to assess that, make sense of it, incorporate it into our lives?
Exactly. The biological function of the orienting response is just what you said. It's to adapt to something new. You have to pay more attention to it. You have to figure it out. What is it? What do I do? And if you were, a swamp critter and all of a sudden the swamp went dry, you need an orienting response to figure out, I better move to another swamp or whatever. But today, the same brain mechanism, which is very primitive, we share it with every other species that has a central nervous system, pretty much. The same thing is being used to sell us stuff.
Yeah. Another thing that I'm curious about, one of the messages I'm getting from what you're talking about with focus is some of it has to do with our ability to not be too distracted, to zero in, resist distraction. Some of it has to do with what we choose to focus on. And in that area, I'm thinking about positive or negative thoughts. You know, so many of us know that our thoughts tend in a negative direction. And we try, right? We try to focus on the positive, you know, think positively, think good thoughts. But it's really hard. Does attention science, provide any insights, any help?
Well, there's an interesting relationship between positive and negative thoughts and attention. And simply this, when we're in a negative space, when we're thinking those negative thoughts, we get constricted, we get defensive, and actually our attention shuts down. If we get really worried, our attention fixates on what we're worried about. When we're thinking positive thoughts, our attention opens up. It becomes more expansive. We can entertain a wide range of possibility. This is one reason, for example, that now in coaching people, the coaches will start with, what are your dreams? What are your hopes? What's your biggest vision? And then work back from there, because that opens up more life possibility.
Well, that's so interesting, because in workplaces, especially these days, we've created workplaces where there's a lot more focus on continual improvement, which often means focusing on what are you doing wrong, what can you do better.
Well, the evidence now shows that telling someone what they're doing wrong, a critical feedback, is actually self-defeating, because it makes people defensive. It puts them in that negative, oh my God, something's, you know, I'm not doing well, what's going to happen? It puts them in that defensive state. Really, it's much better to talk to a person about what they can improve next. In fact, this is the key. You know, there's this myth of 10,000 hours of practice.
Yeah.
everybody talks about, well, do it 10,000 hours. That's actually a distortion of the original research by Anders Ericsson at the University of Florida, who studies expertise and people at the top of their game. He found that people who were really superb had practiced at least 10,000 hours, and those who weren't as good had practiced less. But that wasn't all. There's another ingredient. He calls it deliberate practice. You need to focus on what you can improve on next, and you need the expert eye of a coach to tell you that. If you look at any Olympic athlete, you look at any, you know, professional singer or professional athlete, they all have coaches. And the reason they have coaches is that a coach tells them, well, you're really, really good, but if you do this next, if you practice this next thing, you'll get even better. And they do that successively. So they have this continual improvement. Most of us amateur duffers, you know, I've got a bad golf stroke, say. If I practice that bad golf stroke 10,000 times or 10,000 hours, I'll still have the same bad golf stroke.
We're talking with science writer Daniel Goleman about his new book, Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. When we come back, we're going to talk more about positive thoughts, coaching, improvement. Daniel has written 10 books, including the groundbreaking Emotional Intelligence. We'd also really love to hear from you in this hour. Do you have questions about how to improve your ability to focus or pay attention? The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Ann Strange Champson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 11 today, it's Garden Talk with Larry Mailer. Today, Larry will be looking at soil health and how to improve the soil in your garden. Right now, we're talking with Daniel Goleman. He's the author of Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. And let's take another call. We've got Tom on the line from Boscobel. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'm curious what effect are the way we receive information in the modern age with tweets and snippets and short stories and so on. Is that detrimental to our attention? And would something, not to be too much of a plug, but Wisconsin Public Radio, where we listen to a single subject for an hour and focus on that, is that helpful?
Well, I couldn't say it, but I'm so glad you did. Hey, Daniel.
I come out on the side of public radio 100% or anything where we keep sustained attention to a topic and keep exploring it and deepen our comprehension. I've been talking to teachers lately who say, you know, kids today don't seem to be able to comprehend text that kids 5-10 years ago were getting easily. Their attention is more distracted. The more our mind wanders, say, about 20 to 40% while we read a book. The more your mind wanders, the more holes you have in comprehension of that book. The same is true of a kid in school. So I think that the shortened attention span, I'll tell you something funny. I was going around to different publishers saying, I want to write a book about attention. And one says to me, oh, that's so great. Keep it short. That's where we've gotten to in this day and age, is the shortening of attention. And I think what we all need is to sustain a continued stream of attention in order to understand things deeply.
And strategies to help us do that. And it's interesting, I was just talking the other day with a literary scholar who's got a new book out called Slow Reading in a Hurried Age. It's a great book. And he talks a lot about what we all have these days, continual partial attention. You know, we're doing something, we're reading something, but we're also out of the corner of our mind paying attention to something else. So he says, a literature scholar, you know, he cares a lot about the quality of reading that we do. And he has tried to kind of put together some rules for how do you read slowly, how other people call it deep reading. How do you bring a different kind of attention to, say, a book you're reading? Because you'll wind up getting much more out of it.
It's not just books. It's, you know, you mentioned continuous partial attention, which is exactly what happens when we do so-called multitasking, which really is switching. The brain doesn't do all those things at once. And when you switch, it diminishes what you're getting in each stream of attention, and it takes longer to get back to full attention once you stop switching. Continuous partial attention is embodied, for instance, in the person in the meeting who's checking their phone constantly or who's on the laptop kind of listening to what's going on, but actually on the web. In a lot, this is so ironic. I've heard that in Silicon Valley, in a lot of the companies that are inventing these very distractors, they forbid electronic devices in meetings because of continuous partial attention.
Right. That's just fascinating. Going back to the positivity thing, which I find just so interesting, partly because I think it's such a challenge for all of us to first notice when you're getting lost in negative thoughts and then switch, have the ability, that executive control, to switch to more positive thoughts. There's a small therapy you mentioned in the book that just fascinated me, something for social anxiety. Maybe you'll remember this. It's about training
it's
the brain.
It's a very interesting approach.
Yeah, well, can you describe it?
Yeah, the therapy actually operates out of awareness, operates unconsciously. It directs people's attention. For example, someone with social anxiety might see a picture of an audience. And if you have social anxiety, you're worried that people are going to judge you and not like you. So your focus unconsciously goes to the one person in the audience who's frowning or seems to be frowning. And in this therapy, it directs your attention to the person who's smiling. So you start to get this positive association with public speaking, for example, and it seems to work. But, you know, you bring up something larger, Anne, which I think is very important, which is the function of anxiety itself and the different kinds of anxiety. There are two basic kinds that clinicians talk about. One is rumination, and rumination is bad anxiety. It's the kind of anxiety where you're worried about that same thing, say that one problem and that one relationship, and you keep coming back to it over and over. You can't get your mind over. You wake up 2 a.m, you go there.
It's sort of like too much focus.
That's the emotionally trapped focus. You know, strong emotions, as I said, trap our attention. But there's another way to worry, which is called, good worry, so to speak, where you think about the relationship. You come up with something you could do or some new understanding or an insight, and then you drop it.
Wow. How do we learn how to do that?
Well, there are some cognitive therapy, for example, is a very good way to do that.
Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of other callers on the line I want to make sure we get to. Let's hear from Jack in Delavan. Hi, Jack.
Hi, good morning. Dr. Goldman, I'd like you to comment on the three things you talked about in terms of leadership, and the third one, leaders becoming more empathetic. In the last place I worked in education, it seemed to me that they wanted leaders who were not empathetic. Uh-huh. They wanted much more hard people who didn't care, but really they wanted people who did what they were told and treated people as they were told to treat them. How do you convince people that that's a desirable quality in leaders and a desirable quality for organizations?
Mm, great question.
Well, Jack, that's exactly what I've been trying to do for the last 15 years. And the evidence really is on your side, not on their side. There was a very powerful article a while ago in the Harvard Business Review called Leadership Run Amok. And it's about just that kind of hard leader who doesn't care about people, who's only interested in hitting the numbers. And it says basically that kind of person who has zero empathy is ruining the organization. They may have some short-term successes, but they're alienating people, demotivating people, and it's a real danger. The most positive leaders, as Anne said earlier, was the ones we want to work for are the people who care, the people who let us know. It's sometimes called secure-based leadership, modeled on good enough parenting, as it's called, where, you tune into a child, you let the child know you understand how she feels and you care about her and you'll take care of her and protect her. And what the research is finding now is that leaders who have that kind of empathy and who let people know that they have their back, not that they're just a cog in a machine, are the ones that people love, that people will give their best effort for, that they have loyalty to. So they really create teams and so on that have top performance. And the other kind of leader, there's a kind of mythos going on in some organizational circles that you need that kind of leader. But I think the data is not just there to support that.
Mm-hmm. We also had a couple of emails. Dennis emailed to ask whether the fact that fear limits our openness to information or knowledge Does that help explain the rise of extreme positions in politics, do you think?
Oh, that's an interesting theory. Let's explore it, because as you say, fear shuts us down. Fear closes us to possibility. And in fact, when we're really fearful and anxious, the brain falls back on overlearned responses, doesn't take in new information, ignores disconfirming information. Does this sound like anyone in politics you know?
No comment. So what do we do about it?
Power of the vote.
Yeah. And Joanne also asks in an email, how do I focus at work when I'm bored by what I'm doing? She says it is exhausting to do this every day.
Oh, yeah. So many of us are in that position. In human resources circle, they call it, quote, the problem of disengagement. Well, the problem is that people are doing work which isn't challenging enough, which doesn't draw on their best skills, which is very routine and boring, frankly. Mm-hmm. So one of the things you can do, and it may not always be possible, is to try to up the ante for yourself, to make it a little more difficult, because that actually does something in the brain. If you can make the challenge that you're facing more equal with the skills you bring to it, it activates the brain. Sometimes you can be lucky enough to get into a state called flow, which is intrinsically pleasant. You're totally absorbed in what you do. The other trick is to up your attention. Mindfulness, for example, is a way of paying full attention to whatever you're doing. You can be mindful while you're washing the dishes. You can be mindful while you're doing a boring routine. But mindfulness activates attention at its utmost voluntarily. So if you can bring an active, mindful attention to what was ordinarily a boring task, actually it won't be so boring anymore. Mm.
And we also have a call from Nancy, who's in Sun Prairie. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning.
Hi, did you have a question?
Yes. I'm wondering if the strategies that were discussed in helping children with ADHD would work with autistic children.
Oh, interesting. Daniel?
Well, autism is a different kind of problem. In autism, kids start to, they're very anxious around other people from toddlerhood on. And one of the things that's just been discovered is that they don't look in, little kids with autism don't look in other people's eyes. They look away. And much of the learning for what's called the social circuitry of the brain comes through paying full attention to other people, watching them. Young kids particularly get implicit rules for how to interact and so on just by watching other, the people in the kitchen. But autistic kids miss out on that learning. So it's actually a deficit in social learning combined with high anxiety about relationships that is one dimension of the problem in autism. And I don't think there's a simple fix for it for ADHD, where you can amp up the concentration circuitry. It's being explored in many, many ways. And one of the things that does seem to help for kids with autism is coaching on the things they missed. What are the social ground rules? How do you shake hands? How do you look someone in the eye? How do you ask how they're doing? If you can learn that cognitively, even if you didn't learn it in terms of the social circuitry, you can get by better. So I think we have a long way to go in the research on autism, and I hope we will come up with some answers soon.
Dan, in the remaining just minute or less that we've got, I just want to ask you, I know you've put out some CDs along with this book, Cultivating Focus, and you've got them for adults, but also for kids and also for teens. If people are interested, what kind of things do you do on those CDs?
Oh, well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because this is the practical part of the book, and it's an instruction in concentration boosting exercises as well as empathy boosting exercises, because I think we need the whole skill set of attention, full sensory awareness. They're available from morethansound.net, one word, morethansound. And in each of them, I tried to do the instruction in an age-specific way. So for the younger kids, you know, you put it in very simple terms. For teens, you do it a little more sophisticated, and then for adults. But it's the same thing. All of us will benefit from practice, and all of these circuits can be enhanced with the right practice.
Dan, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure.
And it was a real pleasure. Thanks.
We've been talking with science writer Daniel Goleman. His book is Focus, The Hidden Driver of Excellence. He's written 10 books, including the groundbreaking Emotional Intelligence. For more information or to check some information, look on our Facebook page. That's 45 North on WPR. Don't go away. There is more coming up. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and this is 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.